This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use in working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC.
Hi, Christy.
Hey, Maggie.
So we are so excited today because we have a very special guest, Dr. Rachel Alfader. She is a doctor in psychology, yes. LPC, RPT, a trauma pro, and has a significant career in play therapy and scholarly research, practice, and really innovative pedagogy. We're really excited to have her. She is founder and owner of the Creative Psychological Health Services, which is in Maryland, Virginia, and DC, offering trauma-informed play and expressive therapies. She was past president and current outreach and networking coordinator for the Maryland DC Association for Play Therapy. She is a member of the American Psychological Association's editorial advisory board and a clinical consultant to leading digital therapy platforms. She's authored multiple articles in the International Journal of Play Therapy, looking at integrating technology and gaming into therapeutic approaches. And you also are a pioneering trainer of CE workshops on virtual and digital play therapy, and recently published a book called Perspectives, which you can get on Amazon. So welcome, Rachel.
Good plug, Rachel.
You plug away.
For those who are just listening, I grabbed my book to make sure to show. I have it handy right beside me.
I love Rachel posts on her Facebook and other social media accounts when people share that they're reading her book from around the globe. You get to see where Perspectives has been, vacations it's gone on.
I just saw the latest was in Brazil. Very cool.
Oh, yeah. It's gearing up to go different places this summer. I had asked people who were going on a vacation travels, let me know. And it has now made its way into a bunch of different luggages. I'm stoked.
It's really cool. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah.
Rachel, did we miss anything that you would like our listeners to know about you?
I will actually just say for a correction, I used to be an LCPC, but I'm no longer an LCPC after I become a licensed psychologist. I just know with licenses, we want to make sure that we are accurately portraying our license. So I used to be.
Now you're a licensed psychologist.
Yes. Yes.
Gotcha. That is very important because I think sometimes people get really confused about what those licensures look like. And so I appreciate you because you can have a doctorate in psychology and not be a licensed psychologist. So it's important to designate the two.
Yes. Yeah. And it's funny when you just said that, I'm like, yes, we all have little alphabet soup behind our name.
Mm-hmm. We do. Yeah. I also think it's important for people to hear that play therapists come from a variety of mental health professions. It's not just counselors or just social workers. We really do have a diverse population, which I think helps enhance the skills, our learning opportunities, as well as multiple perspectives that we may look through things based on our different training. So,
and I think it's really helpful too, Rachel, because I think psychologists are probably the least represented group in Association for Play Therapy. And it seems like the Maryland, DC area has a high percentage of psychologists that are play therapists. And so I really appreciate that, and that you're working within APA, because it's a smaller percentage. And so it's, I'm glad that you're here and doing that work. So
yeah, I've noticed that as well. And I think the hard thing is play therapy doesn't tend to be a part of our core education, our meaning the field as a whole. There are several programs, there are certificate programs. And then of course there's a choose your own adventure, which I think a lot of people tend to go that route, obtaining different CEs to, you know, put together to become a registered play therapist. But yeah, I think that it's because it's not something that's incorporated in a lot of education that there's, generally speaking, minimal exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and oftentimes we follow what we learn, right? Because why would we not?
Yeah.
We're being trained. We follow what we're being trained in. So if we have certain supervisors or certain professors or, you know, university that we attend focuses more on a certain theoretical framework, we kind of fall into that, right? And then we just take the training, we have the field experience that we do, and then that's where we go. And you know, I don't think that enough people have exposure or knowledge. And in the spirit of perspective, I'm sure that's going to come up a lot. You know, a lot of times if we are very educated and skilled in a certain area, we might be a little bit more hesitant to venture into other areas because we start to become very adamant and focused and, I don't know, maybe even aligned with what we've learned. So why venture into something else, learn something different if we know this method, whatever this method may be, is the most effective method? You know, it's evidence-based, it's research-informed. So I think that sometimes tends to inhibit people. And that's not to say people aren't attending additional training and obtaining certain certifications. But yeah, I think that that's a big reason why it's not incorporated in different licenses or.
So I have a question. So this is something that I started realizing since I've moved to this area, but it seems like there's a large contingency of play therapists that really kind of worked with and around Dr. Eliana Gill. And I've met so many amazing people that got their start there. So I was kind of curious, when you were in school, were you interested in play therapy, or was it that you got to the Gill Institute? How did your journey to play kind of begin? Because it's definitely interesting, the regions. There's a lot in Texas that were UNT. And then here, it really seems Eliana Gill and the Gill Institute was a big part of that. But I'm not sure. So I'm curious.
Wow. I want to just say, because I'm thinking this and I just say what's on my mind.
Yeah.
I feel like we're on the Hot Ones series, the YouTube ones, because I just feel like you have really great questions. You know, like they're like the questions that people don't usually ask. But, you know, I just want to say, I feel like we just sans the hot wings, but I just want to say this is lovely. So I'm joking.
Okay, we can look at adding hot wings to our podcast here and have them delivered to everyone's house before at 9 a.m. in the morning.
Oh my gosh, that sounds fantastic.
It would be fantastic.
Maybe wake you right up. But anyways, I'll actually answer your question. I thought about that. So I wanted to share what was on my mind, but yeah. So I want to start off by saying Dr. Eliana Gill is my psychology idol, is my play therapy idol. So I want to say that that is not how I started. I didn't venture into the Gill Institute first. I actually was very fortunate to connect to a child adolescent psychology practice when I was in my master's program. And they provided play therapy and trauma-informed care. I knew I wanted to work with kids and teens. I knew that. I was a coach when I was in high school. I volunteered a lot. I love kids. I knew I wanted to have a field in, as my son's nanny says, the baby industry. I wanted to work with kids, but I didn't know in what way. So I started working at this placement and fell in love with the work. And that just, I mean, that changed the trajectory of my career. And so I started learning about play therapy. I started learning about trauma work. And then I was introduced to one of Dr. Gill's books. My supervisor had us read a book and I was hooked. And then just absolutely love Dr. Gill, all of her work. And then it's been really cool. I'm jumping ahead a little bit. It's been really cool to get to know her as a person too and work alongside of her in a variety of contexts. I feel very fortunate. So I, at that time, when I was in my master's field placement, recognized that I really wanted to pursue play therapy more and began at that site, my RPT, and learned about the Association for Play Therapy, joined as a member, and then it continued on from there. So I then went into my doctoral program and continued to pursue placements that aligned with play therapy, ended up becoming a registered play therapist in my doctoral program. And then once I graduated, I actually worked at Yale Institute as an unofficial postdoc. Oh, and when in my doctoral program, this will probably come up too, my dissertation. My dissertation is on incorporating technology in play therapy. So I'll just introduce that right now, but I'm sure we'll come back to that at some point. And I reached out to Dr. Gill, and I didn't think she would respond, but I explained I was conducting my research. I was looking for readers for my dissertation, and she
Oh.
responded. And I will forever remember when she responded to that email where I was. It's like one of those
Yeah.
those moments. Oh, I think I laughed and cried at the same time internally. It was, oh my gosh, it was amazing. She served as a reader on my dissertation committee, and then that helped the step into the postdoc become a pretty smooth step.
So we've talked about dissertations before, but it's a monumental, huge piece of the doctoral program, and you have professionals in the field who have their doctorate already to serve on your committee, and they basically read it and ask you questions and make sure that what you're saying is accurate.
Aligned with the data that you collected and ex the questions you explored.
And so it's a big commitment. So what a like that takes a lot of courage to reach out to someone, and then the excitement of her being willing to be such a big part of that journey. That's really cool.
This is so important. I live by this, and I encourage everyone to do the same. The answer is always no unless you ask. And if you ask and the answer is no, you're right where you are. What have you lost? Someone once did respond to that, and they're like, pride. I mean, I hear that. I hear it. It is really tough to be confronted with rejections, and it's an inevitable part of the process of life, of leadership, of stepping out into the unknown, into introducing something different. Like, it's just that is what happens. So
It's interesting. I talk to doc students about research. What do you think sets you apart? It's just relationships that I'm not scared to go out and say, hey, I'd like to work with you. And it's hard when you think about it, though, progressing my career, that's really the first step of really starting to do something important. And so for a long time, I minimized it and I'm just doing relationships. But the reality is, taking that brave step and reaching out has really impacted your entire career.
oh, yeah, multiple times. And I will say, I reached out to another well-known play therapist and they had said no. And that's okay. That's going to happen. I think a lot of times people do look at other people's highlight reel and they see the things that they're doing and, oh, they get in their own way. I'm not going to be able to do that. Or it's part of the process. It is part of the process. And yeah, I'm a huge relationship builder, just genuine, authentic relationships. And I do think that that has helped. That wasn't at the forefront, right? I like people, right? I mean, we are in a helping profession, and it's been really exciting to be introduced to a variety of different people and projects and opportunities just from genuine connections.
Yeah, for sure. That's awesome.
So, talk to me a little bit how you, because I know you are a supervisor, when you're supervising new employees or clinicians in the field, how do you help them navigate that space of, well, I could just do what feels right to me. Oh, do you know what I mean? Like, how do you marry the two of them? Because it's always feels like a challenging conversation when you're kind of pushing into the, yes, but what's your intentionality? Tell me more. How is that rooted? Where did you decide to do that? Like, I want to get into purpose, intention, and I know sometimes that's not where my students want to go.
I just want to say this is the next level, hotter wing.
Oh, sorry.
No,
We
I
can do
actually
that. We can do that a lot here. So.
I don't mean that it's anything negative. I actually was thinking that these questions are so thought-provoking and beautiful, and back to the intentionality, that they're just so intentional. It's really lovely. So I think that your questions are are fantastic. And that's why I keep referring back to the hot ones, because I'm impressed by the questions that they ask. An average interviewer wouldn't ask or know. So that's why I keep joking about this. I'm really appreciating this discussion. So I'm going to go back to perspective because I can't help myself. So I really lean into a child's perspective. That's the start. Now, this does align with my humanistic framework. I will come back to theory momentarily, but I will say at the start, as I'm going into this, this does align with my humanistic theory. I really want to see people to the core, who they really are. And I think a lot of times people don't really know who they are because we learn about ourselves based on how other people tell us that we are, right? We learn, people kind of serve as mirrors, especially throughout our early childhood. And who we are is reflected back from their mirror, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I really want to get to the core of who somebody is, what they've experienced, how they think, what got them there, you know, what's plaguing them, what they need, et cetera. You know, I really want to delve in. So I think it's so important when meeting kids where they are to really understand, perspectively speaking, where they are. What have they experienced? What do they want? What do they need? What do they not want? You know, all the things. That's my focus. And play is a beautiful space to allow a child to organically show you that. Now, again, we might not necessarily know, symbolically speaking, metaphorically speaking, all that is occurring. And whatever's in the forefront of our mind is going to play out, literally. It is. You know, if there's something that we're thinking about, it flavors the way we interact with the world. It flavors the way that we talk. It flavors the way that we view ourselves, right? I mean, inevitably, the things that we encounter are going to impact who we are, what we're doing, where we're going. So in meeting kids where they are, that's the perspective is the core. And I think any framework can connect to that. From a humanistic framework, I'm leaning into that. You know, for CBT, then we're maybe meeting kids where they are in their thoughts and their feelings and helping shift some of that to adjust behaviors, perhaps, or adjust feelings. So it's more cathartic and healthy for a child. But yes, I think that it is easy for us to throw out some buzzwords like meet kids where they are and speak their language and all these things. And I think it's so important to pause and really understand what that means. That's why I love this question. What does that mean for you when you think, and I'm speaking to everyone listening, when you are thinking about truly meeting a kid where they are, what does that mean for you? Now, me just talking about perspective, that might make sense to you. Might say, in addition to that, or in lieu of that, what does that mean? How do you show up for the client? How do the clients show up for themselves? That's a core. Then how do you view, conceptualize problem behavior? How come people struggle from your perspective? Is it because of the systems that they are a part of? Is it because of a misalignment, misattunement with self? Is it because there are core beliefs that are impacting the way that they're moving about the world? Is it, you know, et cetera, whatever it is that your framework is, how do you conceptualize challenges? And then how can you blend the two? But really, I think it's so important for you to truly reflect and not just regurgitate what we've learned. And it's hard to not just regurgitate what we've learned because we're learning, right? And it's important what we're learning. Yeah. But really pause and ask yourself with intentionality, how am I viewing this? How do I feel about this? And how does this then impact the way that I show up as a clinician?
And I think regurgitation is the first phase of yes. becoming yes. a professional, right?
Yes.
Sometimes we want to mimic or mirror our idols, right? So I'm sure there was a time when you were idolizing Dr. Gill, you would go in with, what would Dr. Gill say in this moment? Or I'm going to do what Dr. Gill said in supervision, or I'm going to repeat word. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I remember doing that with Dr. Yes. Landreth and Dr. Ray and Dr. Breton, where I'd be like, how would this person handle this scenario?
I still have Dr. Ray in my head.
Yeah, right?
Yes. Yes.
But then what slowly starts to happen is you feel more assured of yourself, competent, right? You start to put a little bit of yourself in this too. And then you're like, well, yeah, you know, Maggie would say this, but my heart says for me to respond this way. And you take the leap of faith and go from your heart instead of, right? Like, regurgitating other stuff. So instead of thinking so hard, you start to really hopefully be present, and like that your more authentic self shows up. And is that, in my experience, was more rewarding and more impactful for the client. I allowed myself to show up more in session and not try to imitate someone else. And one of my favorite quotes that Gary says is, there's only one Gary Landreth. I don't need a whole bunch of little chicklets walking around the world like pretending to be me. Chicklets wasn't his word. I threw that in there. I should say quail. But if you know, one of Gary uses that in one of his videos. But do you know that idea? There, you can only authentically show up. There, you can't be someone else. You might try to emulate someone else, but you authentically have to be the one in the relationship. And so there's only one Gary Landreth. There's only one Rachel Altbader. There's only one Maggie Parker. There's only one Christy Obiola. And although we influence people, we have to really encourage people's authentic selves to show up in therapy. Or we need to gatekeep, right? We need to make sure if people's authentic selves aren't a good match for therapy, our job is to gatekeep in those moments, to say, let's process this a little bit. Let's figure out what's going on and then figure out if this is the right area of specialty for you.
And I think,
and this might be true for humanistic counselors. I'm not a more directive counselor. And so with manualized treatments and other stuff, there might be times that you can't authentically show up, but I hope you ask the questions in authentic ways from your approach, because you might have a manual or a strict protocol that you have to utilize, but just even the tone of your voice, the way you ask things allows you to be part of that relationship.
Yeah, the way you show up, absolutely. And it's interesting. I was thinking about manualized treatment with what you were saying, Christy, that when I first started, I was so anxious that I was not doing it the right way. And I wanted to do things the way that my professors and supervisors and idols did. And I very much did try to mimic that to the extent that I could. And I just always thought I'm never going to be as good. And like, these are all the thoughts that I'm thinking. This is imposter syndrome. I just want to name that. This is imposter syndrome. It's so much, though, to learn all of these new theories and interventions and watch your face and self-reflect and my goodness.
On your hands and...
My goodness. It's so much. It's so overwhelming. The beginning is always the hardest. And it was really preferred for me to grab that manual and have a manualized treatment approach, because it was so much more helpful for me to know exactly what to do and how to do it. So literally that was helpful, but also figuratively with what you're saying with, yes, I want to follow the manual of this professor, follow the manual of this professor, follow the manual of this supervisor. And that is how we learn, right? Mm-hmm. We try out the things that we learn. And yes, I love that you are really speaking to the beginning for so many people, because I know how much this resonates. And yes, me speaking about where I am now, this is, I don't know, maybe like 15-ish years in now from when I first started. So yeah, it's going to be a different chapter than when I first start. And remembering that, remembering where you are, part of the process, and just, you know, we want to normalize that along the way. So yes, I want to say I absolutely did feel that way. And it's interesting. I had provided a speech at a graduation on imposter syndrome, and specifically talked about what we're talking about here, how, you know, kind of wanting to do the things that other people were doing and feeling inferior, truly. And then really realizing that I am me and I am unique, right? Exactly what you're saying with Dr. Landreth's quote, mm-hmm. right? There's only one of me. And so we're going to show up in the way that we show up that aligns with us, and the people who we are meant to support will gravitate towards that, and will hopefully benefit from that. And if there's misalignment, let's say a clinician has a different approach than a client really could benefit from, well, then we're just not the clinician for them. And that's okay. There are so many different people in this world. And I know it's hard to not take it personally. We're just not going to be friends with everyone. We're not going to be everyone's clinician, right? We're not going to be the best match of supervisor or supervisee. It's not a personal attack. It's just, we're all different. So we have to figure out what feels right for us and those who we serve.
Which is also such an important lesson for new clinicians, because I think when you start out, let's be honest, we're in debt, right? Yeah. Like we want to be able to pay our rent and eat and have the electricity on. So we do think financially sometimes. And so we feel like we have to alter ourselves to match every client. And I remember doing that as a new clinician. That was somewhat problematic and not always helpful for my clients, because I can't warp myself all the time into all these different people. because it is, you feel lost a lot of the times. I remember I felt like I was like in a desert having no idea, like, what tool do I use? Why would I don't, okay, you need this. Okay, I'm going to study as much as I can on this. And then it comes in session and none of that feels right because now the client is presenting something different from last week or, you know, talking about. And so it's hard. And it's so important to know kind of your wheelhouse, what you specialize in. It's okay to, you know, have one or two theoretical approaches that you align with and that you practice. And it doesn't mean you can't use techniques from other people. It really matters how you're conceptualizing what the purpose is and kind of helping. So I hope what our listeners are hearing is we get where you're at, especially if you're a new clinician or just coming out of school, right? And we want to also encourage you in some ways to have the courage to really say, oh, I might not be a good clinician for you. Let me help you find someone that matches better for what you're looking for. I don't know about you guys, but my experience is when I do that, I get more clients because people trust that I'm not wheeling and dealing. I'm not a snake oil salesman. I'm not doing any of those crazy things. And so they're like, oh, okay, she's really trustworthy. I'm going to refer them over here for help. And, you know, your client ghosts you one day and never calls back and you try to get a hold of them and they're like, oh gosh,
that's the worst.
Don't go to this person. That's my vision of what happens outside of session. I don't know that that's true, but.
I really wish that we had a lot more time because I have so many things I want to talk to you about.
Come back.
I'll just have to come back. Absolutely. Tell us about your book.
Yes. So it's Perspective. It's right here again. Shockingly, right next to me. I found that in everything that I was doing personally, professionally, I just kept seeing perspective, how different people see different things, how they come about being who they are. And so I randomly one day thought, let me write a book because we all think that. I don't know. No. So I just kept writing all my different thoughts and came up with this beautiful passion project. The book is all about how we come to see ourselves, others, and the world. It's broken up into three different sections. So it starts with origins, talks about psychological development, neuroscience, ultimately how we, from those frameworks, start to develop an understanding as humans. The next section is reflecting inward. It's all about how we see self and others, how others see us, and how accurate or inaccurate it is. And as I have mentioned, it's all about how we really start to form an idea of who we are through other people's mirrors, what other people tell us about ourselves. And then the third section is all about, it's a social framework. So it's all about how we can rebuild the foundation of our society. It's idealistic, but to really be able to have a space for everyone's perspective at the table and recognize that one person's not right and one person's wrong is that we all live within our reality. And it's important for us to lean into everyone's realities to have a more cohesive, collaborative perspective.
Awesome. And it's available on Amazon.
Yeah. So actually Amazon for now, it was placed on some other sites, but for now it's just Amazon or me. You can get it through me.
Awesome.
Nice little signature copy.
Yes. So go to your website and we'll
reach out to my social. So we'll link in the description and you can find me there and reach out to me.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for coming and listening in this week on our Playful Beginnings podcast. Remember to
please like and subscribe.
Yes. And you can find Rachel on social media. What's your page? Should we make sure everybody has it?
Yeah, so it's actually beacons.ai/Doc Vader. All of my socials are connected there. So we'll link the description for you.
Awesome. And we'll put it in the description. And then you can find us at playtherapyspace.com and playtherapyspace on all of the socials.
And if you have any questions or comments or topics you want us to cover, don't forget to send us an email or comment below. Email is at info@playtherapyspace.com. Thanks, y'all, for tuning in.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.